Chapter 8. Looking Backwards, Going Forward. When Imran Khan took office as Prime Minister of Pakistan in August 2018, he began his maiden address to the nation thus. There are two types of politics, one in which one would pursue his career, and the second, my role model, Qaid-e-Azam, Muhammad Ali Jinnah, who conducted politics for a mission that our Prophet Hazrat Muhammad brought revolution in the world's history by creating State of Medina. An Islamic welfare state envisioned by Allama Muhammad Iqbal, which have showcased in the Comity of Nations that what is real Islam. After invoking these three historical figures and tying them by the thread of Islam, he went on to sketch plans for his Naya Pakistan. In its 70th year, it seemed that the Islamic Republic of Pakistan had settled down to some kind of democratic pattern, or, as some political scientists have suggested, a hybrid regime. After seeing four spells of military rule in six decades, Pakistan had seen three successive elections since 2008. In these, a tripartite contest had been waged between the Pakistan People's Party of the Bhuttos, the Sharif Brothers Pakistan Muslim League, Nawaz, and Imran Khan's Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf, with each winning in turn. This sustained democratic spell has, though, been under the twin shadows of the military and the mullah, religious leader. Bedeviled by political violence, blighted by severe political corruption, and beset by a tight-knit biradari, brotherhood or kinship, public sphere, the people have drawn unity from, in the words of historian Faisal Devji, the idea of belonging to a land rather than belonging to it in its present form. Much as the old Pakistan movement of the 1940s was in pursuit of a new Medina, so the new Pakistan of Imran Khan in 2020 seeks a Riyasati Medina, State of Medina. Jinnah's dream was powerful enough to become a reality, but it was also vague enough to be malleable in a disenchanting manner. As we have heard, weak institutions, lack of leadership, and above all, conflicting ideas about how to build the land of the pure, opened up space for rigid structures and harsh ideologies to thrive. Beneath and beyond them, over generations, the restless young oscillated between agitation for their hopes and accommodation, with the attendant danger of disillusionment, born out of fear, insecurities, and inequities. Straddling these social fault lines, and personifying some, Imran Khan came into office in 2018 on the promise of eradicating big-ticket corruption, overhauling Pakistan's seriously debt-ridden financial problems, and breaking away from the lifestyle of those in power. He sought help from the youth, the Pakistani diaspora, and countries willing and able to help Pakistan, chiefly China and Saudi Arabia. What is new about Naya Pakistan? Is it simply old Pakistan that has been dressed up in a new outfit? Or has anything fundamental changed? While ultimately only time can tell, anthropologist Amara Maqsood and historian Ali Usman Kazmi have noted one key societal change alongside structural continuity in Pakistan's new middle class, which seems to have broken away from its predecessor in three significant ways. First, it has become politically more active than previously, when it was a passive observer and supporter of the military. Second, it has expanded considerably since the days of Zia, consolidating through the years of the Bhutto and Sharif premierships and gathering strength during nearly a decade of Musharraf's government. State, market-oriented economics remained the same through all three phases. Third, as its voice became further magnified in the emerging echo chambers of social media, its socio-cultural ascendancy has been accompanied by a religious turn, one which, when yoked to nationalism, allowed the new middle class to shift away from the provincial client-patron networks of the older feudal parties, and helped propel Imran Khan to prime ministerial office, if not to power. Among this ambitious class and those aspiring to join their ranks, it is the youth, in particular, to whom Imran Khan owed his electoral victory in 2018. His old-new popularity amongst them, combined with their frustration with the clannish political parties of the Sharifs and Bhuttos, allowed him to embark on his long Azadi, Freedom March, following claims of election rigging during the 2013 general election. According to a UN Development Programme, UNDP, report of 2018, 64% of the country's population is below the age of 30. His political rhetoric and ability to capture a sense of the historic resonated among millennials and post-millennials, many of whom were voting for the first time in 2018, resulting in a vote for change. Like populist leaders before him, and those elsewhere, he pinned his hopes for the nation and political fortune on the potential of the youth and the aspirational middle classes. For this support to materialise, however, poverty alleviation and social uplift policies are crucial. One third of Pakistan's population still lives under the poverty line, and it is ranked at 150 out of 189 in the latest UN Human Development Index. Yet its defence expenditure, one of the highest in the world, comfortably outweighs its commitment to education, which is one of the lowest. Indeed, on all major socio-economic indicators, from mortality to literacy rates, from access to clean water, sanitation facilities, healthcare to electricity supply, country-wide figures are less than flattering. And they are further skewed among the regions by the rural and urban divide and by the gender divide. Overall, according to UNDP, multidimensional poverty plagues Pakistani provinces, some more than others, such as Fateh and Balochistan, but in all, between one-fourth and one-third of the population remains poor, and the situation is getting worse. This widening gap, keeping in mind that the young among the poor have only seen a post-Zia Pakistan, with its prominent military, all-permeating religion, and pervasive intranational and international conflicts, is the toughest of the intersectional challenges in Pakistan. All this makes for a resilient society, but also a restless one, seeking change. Regulating and monitoring dissent is a colonial inheritance in the region, and sedition laws of a different era have been carefully crafted to suit the purposes of the past 70 years. They are designed not just to detain protesters, but also to deter those who question authority. 35 years of military dictatorships and stop-start democratic infrastructure has at least led to a small, critical civil society. This group, generationally renewed by students and other young people, periodically bursts into life, as in that famous year of protest of 1968, when its uprising brought down the dictatorship of Ayub Khan in March 1969. 15 years later, in 1984, Zia banned student unions, no doubt fearing that history might repeat itself. As recently as 2018, a student solidarity march reawakened old state suspicions and resulted in some of the organisers being arrested. The group is an umbrella organisation that demands a reinstatement of student union elections, an increase in education investment, and a lifting of the ban on students participating in political activities. Protest in Pakistan is, however, not owned by critical youth. Organisations like the JUIF, split branch of Jamiat Ulema-e-Islam, Assembly of Islamic Clerics, led by Fazul-ur-Rehman, a cleric politician who turned Imran Khan's brand of street march protest politics against him in 2019, and TTP, Tehreek-e-Taliban, the Pakistan Taliban, an armed group that has engaged the Pakistani army along the Afghan frontier, continue to challenge the state. With the Muhajir fault line in Sindh, the nationalist fringe in Balochistan, and students across campuses in the country, various aspirational voices demanding change from their perspectives, and through various methods, are agitating quietly and publicly, making effective use of social media. In Pakistan, this is dominated by Facebook, which has an overwhelming market share of 94%, 2020, compared to Twitter's paltry but no doubt rising figure of 4%. On the whole, though, active social media users number around a fifth of a population of 220 million, a figure that is only going to rise with smartphones enabling wider data connectivity. The use of new technologies presents challenges and opportunities, but it also exposes the gaps within society in terms of accessibility. Still, the trend here too is one way. In 2019, China Mobile Pakistan, CM Puck Limited, with its brand name Zong 4G, conducted Pakistan's first 5G tests, the first to do so in South Asia. Apart from the enhanced censorious attempt by the state to keep a watch on this increasing flow of information, the other limitations to an information revolution are societal, namely low literacy, financial, limiting access to technology, and cultural, the overwhelmingly gendered nature of the virtual space, mirroring the public spaces. Women have lower rates of literacy, less ownership of mobile phones, and are less likely to use the internet. Naturally, this leads to fewer women being visible, let alone vocal. Women who do use the internet generally inhabit urban, elite or quasi-elite, upwardly mobile strata of society, and their usage is often for a different purpose. Among Pakistani women, social networking becomes socializing and keeping in touch with friends and family. In comparison, more men seem to use social media to gather information and project influence. Across South Asia, this discrepancy represents the still gendered, indeed newly gendered, norms of educational opportunities, material autonomy, digital training, and a discriminatory playing field. Greater access and usage of smartphones has also resulted in greater online surveillance. Data protection laws were weak to begin with, but the 2016 Prevention of Electronic Crimes Act brought regulation of the internet. Its empowering of state authorities to gather and retain data has been seen as a weapon of mass surveillance, violating individual privacy, stifling civil liberties, and encouraging self-censorship. But these are existential matters for only a small top layer of society. Online trolling, the spread of misinformation, and propaganda wars waged by self-appointed or state-manufactured social media warriors are further concerns. These are global conversations, and South Asia states are new players in the field. At the same time, all of this is also part of a cultural reimagining that continues in the more widespread medium of the small screen. With the continued ban on films and television programmes from India, though those with access can watch these via online platforms, Pakistani audiences have been enthralled to Turkish productions. The popularity of programmes such as Dirilish Ertuğrul, Ertuğrul's Resurrection, a historical drama based on the life of a 13th century Muslim whose son Osman Ghazi went on to establish the Ottoman Empire, is in turn utilised by Imran Khan's government for encouraging Islamic culture in contrast to what is perceived as morally questionable and Islamophobic entertainment from Hollywood and Bollywood. Such endorsements have reignited the old debate on what can be considered Pakistani history and culture. Equally, there is accompanying anxiety as to how these global or pan-Islamic projects envelop and dilute local cultures. The programme has been accused of promoting violence, distorting history, and promoting a Turkish vision of pan-Islam, all of which ensured that it was banned in Saudi Arabia and the UAE. In Pakistan, Such examples reinforce the shift to generally looking west, whether towards Turkey or the Gulf, for remaking Pakistani cultural identity, as opposed to the east, towards India, from which it has worked hard to divorce, distinguish, and distance itself. The pull towards India is diminishing rapidly, with reduced interpersonal contact, especially since the two successive electoral victories of the fiercely Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party in India, the passing away of a generation with shared histories and memories, and the loosening of the threads of Hindustani language and pan-North Indian culture. The links with Turkey, in any case, extend beyond cultural and religious kinship. Turkey was one of the first countries to recognise Pakistan in 1947, and, ironical in light of current goings-on, Jinnah looked to Mustafa Kemal Atatürk's secular Turkey as a model to emulate. A design that was also briefly revived by General Musharraf. More recently, the first metrobus to be built in Pakistan, in Lahore, inaugurated in 2013, was a collaborative project between the Punjab and Turkish governments. While both Pakistan and Turkey have turned away from those mid-20th century ideals of a modernizing and secularizing Islamic Republic, this has opened up other possibilities for pan-religious and populist nationalist inspirations. Meanwhile, in a bid to make Pakistan attractive to the outside Western world, the government has taken to promoting tourism with the aim of changing the country's international image from terrorism to tourism and making it an attractive tourist destination. The security situation today is comparatively more stable than the period 2009 to 2014, one of intense activity by the Pakistan Taliban. Under successive army chiefs since Musharraf, Ashfaq Parvez Kayani and Rahil Sharif, the military and the ISI, Inter-Services Intelligence, launched operations like Rahi Rast in Sawat and Zabi Azb in Waziristan. From Karachi to Khyber and from Huila to Wahab, Pakistan remains a country of many difficulties and conflicts, but its hard image is being softened. Behind the motivation to change Pakistan's image lies the dire economic situation, the declining value of the Pakistani rupee, and the billions of dollars owed to the International Monetary Fund. Lifting visa restrictions and enabling electronic visas, along with a few well-placed foreign tourists to publicise brand Pakistan, are the latest government initiatives in this direction. The slow growth between 2014 and 2020 has been pegged back by the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic, but there is no denying the appeal and potential benefits of this attempt. First, it seeks to capitalise on Pakistan's still unspoilt beauty in its northern areas, Khyber Pakhtunkhwa and Gilgit-Baltistan, by trying to re-establish some of the old 1960s hippie trails, encouraging mountaineering and trekking in the Hindu Kush range, and expanding on establishments like the Malam Jaba ski resort dating from the 1980s in Sawat Valley, much of which had been destroyed in 2008 by the Pakistan Taliban after being declared un-Islamic. Geologically, northern Pakistan is located on an active fault line where the Indian and Eurasian tectonic plates meet, making it highly prone to earthquakes. In October 2005, an earthquake of 7.6 magnitude, with its epicentre at Balakot, devastated Azad Jammu and Kashmir and surrounding areas. It was one of the deadliest earthquakes in recent times, with an estimated death toll of 75,000 to 85,000 people. Relatedly, in July 2010, the Indus River Valley saw flash floods following a record-breaking monsoon, which brought untold misery to over a million people across all the major provinces who were displaced. These environmental challenges remain, especially given climate change, but equally important is the need to create an eco-friendly and sustainable infrastructure. The second strand of tourism is multidimensional, people-oriented, and has a diplomatic value. 3 kilometres away from the India-Pakistan border, in Pakistani Punjab, is the Gurdwara in Kartarpur, the final resting place of Guru Nanak, founder of the Sikh faith. On the other side, in Indian Punjab, is the bustling holy town of Dera Baba Nanak, again associated with the life and times of the Guru. In November 2018, the governments of India and Pakistan took the momentous step of opening a corridor between these two Gurdwaras to enable visa-free travel for pilgrims, a long-standing desire of the Sikh communities of both countries. The development of this corridor was completed in time to mark the 550th birth anniversary of Guru Nanak in 2019. The Sikh community is concentrated in the Indian Punjab, but some of the most significant shrines associated with the faith are located in Pakistani Punjab, another sad outcome of India's partition. In recent times, these have been renovated to attract Sikh pilgrims from the diaspora and also from India too, but with the latter being at the mercy of the fluctuating relationship between the two governments. The Kartarpur Corridor is therefore the kind of spiritual tourism that the Pakistan government is keen to promote because it also shows the state in a positive light vis-à-vis its minorities, in addition to generating capital. However, by recreating these links with the Sikhs, the Pakistani state also runs the risk of reopening old accusations of propping up the Sikh separatist Khalistan movement in India and abroad. On the other hand, in 2019, a statue of Maharaja Ranjit Singh, 1780-1839, was installed near Lahore Fort as a tribute to that Sheri Punjab, as a son of the soil. Soon, perhaps not entirely unsurprisingly, it was subjected to vandalism, revealing the difficulty of untying the threads of religion, nation, and region. But the issue of minorities, their political representation, inclusion in the national narrative, and place in the history of Pakistan continues to be central to the question, who is a Pakistani? This is especially important because the pool of people to choose from continues to shrink. Overall, across the post-colonial world, a relative lack of political stability, due to both external and internal factors, and historic and new, has hampered economic growth and social development in Pakistan. The country has weathered many storms and remains resilient, if slightly worn and fraying at the edges. Pakistan today may not be the promised land to which many fled in August 1947, but after more than 70 years, it is certainly not a people without history, as the historian Faisal Devji suggests. That history, though, continues to be reworked and reimagined for a younger audience. The older, and some would argue more inclusive, memories have given way to newer and more exclusionary ambitions.